Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
I would like to formally start the talk. I want to just dive right into some historical details, and then I'll expand outward from there. And the details come from my 2023 book, La Duchesse, a biography that I wrote about the niece and heiress of the famous French 17th century prime minister, Cardinal Richelieu. I don't know if that name is familiar to some of you. So her name, the 17th century duchess, was Marie de Vignerot, and she was titled the Duchess of Aiguillon. And one of many things that I found out about this 17th century woman that made me want to write a book about her in the first place was that, among many other remarkable things she did in her life, she was a great patroness of writers, scholars, and artists. And among those whose works that she supported were a young female mathematician named Marie Curie, as well as the more famous young mathematician Blaise Pascal when he was very young. She also supported the poetry and dramatic work of Pascal's sister, Jacqueline, and she helped the careers, too, of some other women, as well as many men, who were devoted to various arts and letters in 17th century France. And one especially interesting book that the Duchess of Aiguillon publicly backed was entitled L'Honnête Femme, which more or less translates, it doesn't mean the honest woman, it actually translates into something like the respectable woman in society, in worldly society. And it first came out in 1632, and it was written by a Franciscan friar named Jacques Dubosc. And it was a bestseller in 17th century France. This is what New York Times bestseller-like books looked like in the 17th century. And so it might surprise you to know, given that it was a bestseller, as it surprised me initially, that it argued for the moral and intellectual equality of women and men well before the Enlightenment period. And it proposed, a bit daringly for the 17th century, that women were capable of great achievements in the arts and sciences, even though they were generally shut out of institutions of higher learning and professions, including teaching, except maybe in a convent school. But they were unable to train in universities for the most part, and they certainly could not become lawyers or medical doctors. So on. Now, when I then learned that there were other books in this vein written by devoutly Catholic authors and favored by some prominent Catholic aristocrats before the Enlightenment period, which traditionally gets the credit for kind of the first significant conversations about male and female equality, I was surprised because no well-educated fellow Catholics in my life or maybe secular professors I had at Harvard and Yale seemed to never said anything like this to me. So I wanted to make sure that the word got out about this and the kinds of things the Duchess was up to. And so it's one of, again, many things that I cover in that book that I wrote. There's a lot more action in the book. She's involved in politics and things at the highest level in France. So it's not simply about intellectual things, but that's one thing related to my book that relates to the topic of tonight's lecture. Now, if such a book appearing in 17th century Catholic France is any sort of surprise, and it certainly was a surprise to me when I first saw it, imagine my shock when I learned a few years ago that around the time the Duchess of Aiguillon died in 1675, another Catholic woman, this one named Elena Lucrezia Cornaro Piscopia, was enrolled at the University of Padua in northern Italy, working her way toward a doctorate in philosophy. And somehow, the fact that the first woman known to have received a university doctorate was a Catholic woman in 17th century Italy had also completely eluded me through the entirety of my formative years in the Catholic faith and in my many years of education and training as a historian. I had been under the impression, differently, that the first women to receive doctorates did so in the 19th century, in settings where the Protestant Reformation and the Enlightenment had made strong impacts. Yet no, the first woman to earn a doctorate did so in Catholic Italy in the 1670s, and she defended her thesis before an audience of 20,000 spectators, supposedly. I think they exaggerated numbers back then the way they do sometimes today. And furthermore, she was a devoutly Catholic oblate of the Benedictine order, or a laywoman privately vowed to chastity and engaged in a regimen of prayers and penitential acts. Now, Piscopia, by the way, leading up to this unprecedented achievement, had mastered Spanish, French, Latin, Greek, Hebrew, and Aramaic, and she had studied mathematics, music, philosophy, theology at advanced levels. And she was drawn especially to theology under the tutelage of a professor named Carlo Rinaldini at Padua, who encouraged her to translate into Italian a Spanish treatise on Christ by a monk named Lanspergius. And this is a rather, to have a woman translating a theological text in the 17th century is rather unusual. It was in some ways frowned upon by some clergymen, but not all clergymen shared that view. So this same clergyman then tried to welcome her into the theology department to get a doctorate in theology at Padua. But the local cardinal archbishop at the time, named Gregorio Barrigo, drew the line at granting a theology degree to a woman. So the consolation prize was to get a doctorate in philosophy. Now, lest you think, as I initially did, that she was an isolated exception, it turns out that 7 of the first 9 women known to have earned advanced degrees, and all in the 17th and 18th centuries, were Catholics in Italy and Spain. And among them was Laura Bassi Varatti, who not only earned her doctorate in physics at the University of Bologna in 1732, but she did so with the enthusiastic support of the Pope at the time. This is Benedict XIV. And then she went on to teach physics as a member of the faculty of Bologna. And she was also elected to the Academy of Sciences of the Institute of Bologna. In her lectures, she encouraged other scientists to take Newtonian physics more seriously, as they were still focused then on some of the teachings of Galen and Descartes. And Bassi, you might like to know, was married to a professor of medicine, and the two supported each other's intellectual work while raising a large brood of children. I couldn't find out how many, but large by 18th century standards, probably a lot of children. And she paved the way for another woman, Christina Roccati, to receive her PhD in physics in 1751. And for Roccati and several other women, a legal scholar named Maria Pellegrina Amoretti and a classics scholar named Clotilde Tambroni, to also receive appointments as university professors in this early period. Now, Pope Benedict XIV, by the way, invited a mathematician named Maria Gaetana Agnese to teach at the University of Bologna, and also supported the university career of another woman named Anna Morandi, who was an expert on human anatomy and lectured for many years to medical students at Bologna. Now, I promise I'll zoom out from these obscure names in a moment, but I just want to give these women their brief moment in the sun because they don't get talked about very often. The other Italians in the group include Maria Pellegrina Amoretti. She was a Northern Italian. She was the first woman to receive a Doctor of Laws degree, which she did at the University of Pavia in 1777. There's also Maria Dalle Donne, who received a doctorate in medicine at Bologna in 1799. And Dalle Donne defended several theses publicly on historical medical themes with great acclaim inside the Church of San Domenico. And these theses treated themes such as comparing historical theories about the structure and operation of various organs in the human body, examining historical learning on the subject of female fertility, considerations on best hygiene and diet practices at the time, and considerations on various diseases that newborns suffered from. So these were rather practical subjects as well as scholarly ones. So Dalle Donne also worked as a physician and a university director in Bologna, and she became a member of the Academy of Sciences in Bologna, as Laura Bassi had before her. Over in Spain, Maria Pascuala Caro Sureda, who studied at the University of Valencia, received a PhD in 1779. 2 years later, she published a work in physics and Mathematics, entitled An Essay on History, Physics, and Mathematics. You could write books like that in those days. If someone tried it today, they'd probably have to self-publish. No one would read it. And in 1789, she became a Dominican nun in Mallorca. So these women tended to be very serious about their faith, as well as very serious about their scholarship. Another Catholic Spanish woman, Maria Isidra de Guzman y de la Cerda, received a PhD at the University of Alcalá and was made an honorary member of the university's faculty. Elected to several academic and royal societies, including Spain's Royal Academy of History, she was respected for her philosophical work and her translations from Latin into Spanish. I'm going to move away from this period. Several years ago, I determined in a conversation with Ignatius Press that I had to do something to communicate to larger audiences than just students in my history classes about women like this, many, many other remarkable women in the history of the Catholic Church that we just don't hear about, maybe because they're not the most famous canonized saints. And so we just assume there are no important women other than sort of the canonized figures that we see in church windows and hear a lot about. And so in discussion with Ignatius Press, I decided to write a book called Women of the Church. And it's part of a book series, the What Every Catholic Should Know series. So I only had a short amount of space. I was given 60,000 word limit, which sounds like a lot to those of you writing senior papers and things like that. But it's really not that much for a book. And so I had to say everything I could as a historian of women in Catholicism in a short volume. And so it's really, I decided instead of doing a sort of traditional Lives of the Saints book, kind of highlighting one woman per chapter, that I would tell the history of the church through the stories of important women, canonized saints, beatified women, and also maybe women who are not necessarily that saintly, but are very important in the history of the church, like Isabel of Spain, for example. So the book goes from the early church to the 21st century. It was a wonderful project. I learned a lot doing it. And I couldn't fit all the women I wanted to. I included about 360 different women in the book, in the narrative. And inevitably at cocktail parties in New York or Connecticut, I'll get asked, oh, but did you cover Saint so-and-so from some obscure medieval saint? And it's usually the one saint I forgot to mention that someone will ask me. And it's like, no, I didn't include that saint, but I wrote about 360 other women. And they feel satisfied. So I lost track for a second. Now, Catholic women in the arts and sciences, they represent just one of many kinds of women covered in this book. But I thought that a focus on the maybe lesser-known tradition of Catholic women in the arts and sciences would be especially appreciated by an audience like this. Obviously, a room full of students, not just officers in training, and you're majoring in all sorts of STEM and humanities fields. So given what I've already shared about some remarkable, if little-known, early modern women in this vein, I want to sort of situate them in a larger historical picture. Now, many Catholics today, increasingly many Catholics today, are aware one way or another of various important scholarly and literary contributions of modern Catholic women. So figures such as St. Edith Stein, Elizabeth Anscombe, Alice von Hildebrand, Flannery O'Connor, Sigrid Undset, these are some important names that come to my mind if we were to look at sort of modern figures. Now, many are aware, too, that a very select group of female saints, Hildegard of Bingen, Catherine of Siena, Teresa of Avila, Thérèse of Lisieux, wrote enough of theological merit that they've come to be honored through papal declarations as doctors of the church or teachers of the church. So when someone's made a doctor of the church, in the Latin sense of doctor, they're kind of elevated as a universal teacher for the whole church. So there are now four women who have this distinction, along with the 33, soon to be 34 men, with John Henry Newman, it will be 34. But the women whose names I've just mentioned are just part of a very long line of scholarly, intellectually accomplished Catholic women going all the way back to the patristic era. And so I want, with the rest of this talk, to give you a sense of the range of these brilliant and faithful women from the monastic, humanistic, and university traditions, who I think more Catholics should simply know about, know their names, if not the details of all of their stories. And then I'll wrap up with a few quick thoughts as to why I believe it's important for us to keep the memory of such women alive. So beginning with the patristic period, or the first several centuries of the church after Christ's time, historians are aware that there were many learned women in the early Christian communities, some of whom were highly respected for their deep knowledge of scripture by church fathers such as Saints Jerome, Basil the Great, and Gregory of Nyssa. Saint Marcella of Rome, for example, was a frequent correspondent with Saint Jerome. Saint Jerome gave us the Latin Vulgate version of the Bible. Now, Marcella of Rome was so important to Jerome's ministry that after her death in the year 410, Jerome praised her as an exceptional student of Scripture who was unafraid to dispute the meaning of passages with him so that she might better understand them. And he wrote at one point, quote, "How much virtue and intellect, how much holiness and purity I found in her, I'm afraid to say, lest I may exceed the bounds of men's belief." And he added, "After my departure from Rome, if any dispute arose in Rome concerning the testimony of the scriptures, it was to Marcella's verdict that appeal was made." So she was kind of the standing in as kind of a teacher on behalf of Jerome after he left Rome. And Church Father Jerome was very comfortable with that and respected her in that role. Now, women such as Marcella of Rome are known to us mainly through the surviving description of them by figures like Saint Jerome. So extant writings actually by women of the patristic era, by contrast, are very few and far between, because a woman might study scriptures, maybe be able to read, but taking the step of writing something and writing something that would be preserved, that was not necessarily a logical step on average for women as much as it would be for men trained as writers. Nevertheless, there are some writings that have survived. And among them is an interesting text, a 4th century text called, my Latin is not that strong, Vergilianus de Laudibus Christi by Proba Betizia Faltonia. She's usually just called Proba. And that text is a rather remarkable cento, or a poem, composed of various verses, passages, and phrases taken by other authors, but arranged in new ways. So you're sort of drawing lines from a variety of different sources that you need to know, often by heart, and then you're creating something new with these lines. That's what a cento is. And for example, it drew verses from the classical poet Virgil, but she used the classical poets to tell stories about Christ and other figures from the Christian Bible. Proba's poem was eventually used alongside the writings of St. Augustine of Hippo and other church fathers in schools where clergymen were educated. Now, early writings by Christian women also include the late 4th century travel narrative of a woman named Egeria of Galicia, or the Itinerarium Egeriae, which survives only in fragments, but was originally a lengthy, detailed account of its author's pilgrimage to the Holy Land, kind of detailing everything she saw and preserving this, the memory of this. And indeed, it was the first pilgrimage narrative of its kind that scholars know of. And we know furthermore about a 5th century text called The Martyrdom of Saint Cyprian. It was an epic poem written by a Byzantine empress. This is the Empress Eudoxia. And she was a woman educated in classical Greek literature as well as Christian literature, and she wrote several other works of poetry as well. Now, a bit later on in the church's history, women's more active engagement in the arts and sciences actually became more common, if a bit sort of hidden behind monastery walls. And this is at the time, of course, of the flowering of monastic communities, which were really, for a period, the only real centers of learning, maybe outside of some royal courts or kind of count's court. And women joined together in monastic communities, as well as men, of course, throughout early medieval Christendom. So Benedictine nuns, such as Saint and Doctor of the Church Hildegard of Bingen, and numerous other women who were vowed to poverty, chastity, and obedience, and were devoted to contemplative prayer. They resided in convents. Most of you, I'm sure you know, they're spaces in which women could pursue learning and artistic activity, as well as prayer, in dedicated ways. Now, women in medieval convents wrote poetry, they studied theology and philosophy, and they painted and sculpted sacred subjects. Some early medieval nuns, such as a woman named Baudovinia of Poitiers, and Hratvita of Gandersheim, were among the earliest Christian authors of historical chronicles and saints' biographies. So some of the earliest hagiographic kind of attempts to chronicle the lives of saints were actually written by nuns. Furthermore, as was true of Hildegard of Bingen, whose mystical and theological writings, such as the Scivias, and whose occasional preaching in public spaces were all approved in her own day by popes and bishops, some also composed sacred music and engaged in botany and other scientific study and experimentation. Now, most medieval nuns who engaged in such work did so anonymously, not seeking fame for it, and this is true of most monks as well. It was not about making a name for yourself in some, you know, public intellectual world, because there really was none outside the monastery, outside they're killing each other, stealing each other's wives and things like that. So the monks, this is kind of a very rarefied, if God's your only audience, that's quite all right. However, there are some women who are known to us by name from kind of the deep dark ages. And among the more artistic among them was a nun named Ende, E-N-D-E, is how her name is typically spelled. And she did beautiful painted illuminations of manuscripts in the 10th century. And up on the screen is one of them. This, I think, is a really stunning depiction of Christ's apostles, completed by Ende in the year 975. And it's preserved today at the Cathedral of St. Mary of Girona in Catalonia in Spain. Now, I mentioned a moment ago women engaged in historical chronicling, something that's close to my heart as a historian. Another interesting medieval nun in that vein was named Hegeberg, and her convent was in the German town of Heidenheim. So Hegeberg of Heidenheim, it's a very early medieval name. She authored a biography of a saint named Willibald. He was the bishop of Eichstätt in 8th century Bavaria. And he told her about his travels to Greece and the Holy Land. And so she chronicled his life and what he told her. And then she wrote the first biography we have of him. She also wrote a biography of his brother. Willibald's brother was named Winibald. Just parents were kind of stuck on the W. So he was an abbot of the same period who participated in an ecclesiastical synod called by King Carloman I, the brother of the famous Emperor Charlemagne. Now, coming back again to Hildegard of Bingen for a bit, she's one of the doctors of the church. I didn't want to give a talk about women in the arts and sciences without at least talking about one doctor of the church. Although St. Hildegard of Bingen is increasingly well known, thanks to her being declared a doctor of the church by Benedict XVI in 2010, I thought that I would say, or maybe it was 2012, I might have gotten that wrong. I thought I would say a bit more about her here, for those of you who have not had a chance to learn about her yet. So Hildegard of Bingen was educated by a scholarly woman who was well-versed in the scriptures and various other Christian texts. And that woman was named Jutta of Spanheim. And Hildegard herself lived from the year 1098 to 1179. So she had a pretty long life. And she was the abbess of eventually several convents in the Rhineland in Germany. Now, especially after she had a mystical experience that she described as a blinding light of exceptional brilliance that flowed through her entire brain. I have yet to have an experience like that after my writing. She became a prolific as a scholar and as a writer. And her first major work, entitled Scibias, part of a Latin phrase that translates as "Know the Ways of the Lord," caught the attention of Pope Eugene III. And Pope Eugene was so impressed with Hildegard that he actually ordered her to keep writing. He wanted her to finish this text. Now, there were other clergymen who didn't necessarily like a woman writing about theology like this, but he gave her his approval, and they had to be quiet. So Pope Eugene, I should point out, was committed to the elevation of the spiritual and intellectual life more broadly in the church, and he quickly deemed Hildegard and her writings to be helpful to these goals. Now, over time, Hildegard engaged in a great deal of cultural and intellectual activity, ranging between artistic projects and scientific studies, while also engaged in a lot of active business as an abbess. She wrote prolifically. Her teachings drew in part on her mystical visions. She experienced a number of mystical visions. And they also drew upon a lifelong study of the scriptures, which she had done since childhood, mentored by Jutta of Svanheim. And when she talks about her mystical experiences, it's often as kind of illuminating scriptural texts. She sees into the kind of the depths of scripture because God's kind of helping illuminate them for her. And when she wrote, she tended especially that there are certain themes that stand out, and one is to underscore the goodness of all God's creation, as well as the majesty of human beings because they're made in the image and likeness of God. So in one of her books, Liber Divinorum Operum, or Book of Divine Works, she emphasized the ability of human beings to access the divine by means of their physical senses. So that kind of appeals to a kind of empirical, scientific way of approaching things. Now, when her teachings, with her teachings in this vein, she actually counteracted, as with St. Dominic, founder of the Order of Preachers, after her, a spreading heresy associated with a group called the Cathars, the Albigensians. And these heretics had a dualistic view of reality. So they saw evil and good as kind of both substantive forces kind of at odds with each other. Instead of the more orthodox Catholic view is that evil is a deprivation of the good. It's kind of the opposite of what exists. And so a lot of Christians fell into this kind of dualistic view. And Hildegard kind of emphasizing the goodness of everything that's physical as created by God. It's only evil insofar it gets corrupted by evil decisions. It sort of helped counteract this heretical tendency that was pretty widespread at the time. So again, these Cathars or Albigensians, they associated the physical parts of creation, such as human bodies, the sexual acts required for reproduction, with evil. And Hildegard, as a nun committed to her virginity and her religious vows, defended the physical aspects of human love and marriage, and defended also the complementary nature of man's creation by God as male and female. And she contributed to the church's understanding of the human person as a unity of body and soul. Now, she wrote also on medical and other scientific topics. She composed poetry and music. She directed artistic nuns in painting representations of her vision. She did not paint herself, but we have these amazing paintings. They're rather odd in many ways, very striking for medieval times, that were painted by nuns in her community, and they represent various visions she had. And so one of them is up on the screen there. And the image of her sitting at her desk is part of another of these paintings, where she's kind of in the painting. So she had herself put there in a portrait. Pardon me. My cold is getting in the way. I don't have real tissue. Pardon me. Now, Hildegard, she's one of many medieval nuns known for such achievements. One of the most learned medieval nuns was a woman named Gertrude the Great, honored as Saint Gertrude the Great. And she was a Benedictine nun and mystic who lived in Thuringia in the Holy Roman Empire. from 1256 to 1302. She's known as Gertrude of Helfta. Now, she was also mentored by another woman, an abbess named Gertrude of Hackeborn. So two Gertrudes, that's easy to remember. Gertrude of Helfta, St. Gertrude, was steeped in the scriptures, as well as the writings of some of the church fathers and some newer Catholic authorities, such as St. Bernard of Clairvaux. Now, similar to Hildegard of Bingen, she experienced mystical visions. Now, mystical visions, modern scholars sometimes like to say that the women had to claim they had mystical visions because it was the only way they had any authority to write about theological matters. There's some truth to that. Women were taken more seriously if they sort of established that they had legitimate mystical experiences. And sometimes the women themselves would kind of emphasize that so that they would not be claiming to have kind of special knowledge on their own power, which there was a bit of a double standard. A man who was trained in theology at a university faculty could claim to have that kind of knowledge simply by natural means. But sometimes that's emphasized almost to the detriment of I think that as a Catholic, I believe these mystical experiences were probably very real. I don't question that. And I don't question that there's some dynamic, interesting relationship between them and the theological texts. But there's some interesting kind of gender analysis that you can get into there. So I just wanted to mention that as an aside. Now, Gertrude, like I said, she experienced mystical visions, and hers began in her mid-20s. And these animated her understanding that through her religious vocation, she was a bride of Christ. This is not necessarily something that all nuns thought of about their vocation at the time. So she ended up writing in kind of a high spiritual and scripturally founded way, explications of what it means to be a bride of Christ as a nun, and telling her own story. And so it became important in kind of teaching other nuns later about what the monastic vocation for women was partly about spiritually. Now, like Hildegard, she was inspired to write a lot, and she produced many works, and probably the most famous of her works is called The Herald of Divine Love, and you can find it in English. It's very, very scriptural. There's a lot of, you can see she had a lot of knowledge of scripture and draws from various church fathers and other authorities, and it also contains spiritual exercises, kind of ways of getting the reader to kind of through prayer and the intellect to kind of enter into the scripture with her. Now, medieval women, just staying on medieval women for a time, and Catholic women also in the Renaissance period and beyond, they contributed to the arts and sciences in the Christian world, not simply as women of learning, but as patronesses of learning. This is an important role that many women as well as men had. And among such women were Saint Jadwiga of Poland, the ruling monarch of Poland at the end of the 14th century. She was actually, some people referred to her as the king. She was in charge of Poland. Her husband was not the ruling monarch of Poland. And she patronized several institutions of higher learning, including Jagiellonian University in Krakow, where centuries later, a certain Karol Wojtyła studied theology, the same man who would become Pope John Paul II, and canonize Jadwiga. This is kind of a nice full circle. Now, Renaissance-era patronesses of higher learning include also the powerful Spanish monarch Isabella of Castile, during whose reign at the end of the 15th and early 16th century, the great University of Alcalá was founded in Spain. And it became a center of humanistic learning, the study of ancient languages and texts. And it attracted scholars from throughout Europe. So Isabella was the main patron, along with a cardinal that she had elevated as Archbishop of Toledo, Cardinal Cisneros, very fascinating figure. Great Catholic patronesses of the arts and sciences included also more ordinary level aristocrats, including figures like the Duchess of Aguillon that I started my talk with, the woman I wrote my book about. And as I show in my book about the Duchess of Aiguillon, she helped mathematicians, poets, philosophers, playwrights, theologians, and historians in achieving their potential and reaching audiences through their publications. And in many ways, women depended even more on patronage because, again, they typically couldn't couldn't be formally educated. And so they needed patrons to kind of pay for kind of more ad hoc ways of educating them, as well as giving them room and board and stuff if they wanted to write books, which I can tell you takes a lot of life out of you and you need time for it. Now, a moment ago, I used the phrase humanistic learning very briefly, and I associated it with the Renaissance. Now, Renaissance humanism, distinct from a kind of modern sense of the word humanism, that often implies a kind of secular vision that human being is at the center of everything, not God. Renaissance humanism, it's a more technical term. It was an intellectual movement originating in Italy in the 14th century, and it involved a flowering of interest in classical antiquity, the study of languages and literature of the ancient world, and a flowering, too, of works of poetry, philosophical dialogues, and biblical scholarship, as well as history and other writings, and in ways that departed from the more formal modes that you see in the universities, in theology and philosophy faculties. Now, among the humanistic scholars and authors of the Renaissance period were some devout Catholic women, and one was the learned and pious Christine de Pizan. She was born in Venice in 1364. She died in France in 1431. She actually worked eventually for the King of France. She had been married for some years, but her husband died, and she had some debts, and her family was connected with the King of France, so she was one of the first women we know of to actually earn a living through writing. She did so at the French court. And she wrote poems, precursors of the novel, books of advice, biographical studies, and her scholarship influenced her daughter, Marie, who in time became a Dominican nun, and it influenced various princesses and other high-ranking people. Now, her most famous book, The Book of the City of Ladies, was completed around 1405. Now, whereas the famous 14th century Italian writer Giovanni Boccaccio, in a collection of stories about great women from history, had focused on those who were reputed to be immoral, suggesting that one could not be both a powerful and a chaste woman at the same time, Pizan was able, through her research, to highlight women leaders who were virtuous in various ways, who had mystical encounters, and had in some cases been willing to die for God. So she was trying to set the record straight about the variety of women, including very virtuous women, who had done important things historically. So she was a bit of a historian as well as a philosopher at the same time. Other devout Catholic women made marks as scholars in the Renaissance period. Among them, she's sort of it's hard to find out too much about her, but her name is Isotta Nogarola. She's from Verona in 1418, the year she was born. She received an excellent classical education. So her parents kind of hired tutors to teach her at home. And she was exceptionally talented in the study of Latin and Greek. And by 18, she was known for her ability to recite entire Latin odes at a very high level. Now, she penned many works, including a biography of St. Jerome. More controversially, a Latin dialogue. She wrote dialogues on the equal or unequal sin of Adam and Eve. And the latter argued against the then commonly held prejudice that woman is both inherently morally weaker than man by nature, even as originally created by God in Eden, and somehow more responsible than man for original sin. She wrote this text, De Pari, while living monastically. She'd never married. She committed herself to prayer and solitude after receiving more hostility than praise from erudite men around her because she had dared to engage them as an equal. So she died in a bit of obscurity. So, now, as women began making their mark in European scholarship and the arts, some Catholic intellectual leaders began to warn contemporaries of the dangers of educating women on a level of parity with men. Normally in history, if you see texts complaining about something, saying this should never happen, it's because it's happening at a high level. The that's making people upset. So you see this kind of increase in texts against women's education in the 16th, 17th century. It's kind of interesting. So it has this kind of weird effect of kind of encouraging, kind of going backward culturally among some people. One such figure, not to pick on him, because he wrote some other good things, there was a Spanish scholar named Juan Luis Vives. He insisted in 1523 that women were inherently weak intellectually and should never be permitted to teach, as they would inevitably drag others into error. Now, Vives, for some reason, had much more confidence that men, by virtue of being men, would be less inclined to go astray from the truth as scholars and teachers, even though by then, the German priest Martin Luther, Swiss priest Ulrich Zwingli, and other learned European men were famously leading souls out of the Catholic Church. I thought that was funny. Now, I never know how that's going to play on people's ecumenical spirit. But not all Renaissance-era Catholic leaders agreed with Vives that women were intellectually weaker than men. And a leading example of an early modern Catholic man who truly believed in women's education was St. Thomas More, who, of course, is famous as King Henry VIII's Lord Chancellor. He was eventually executed for refusing to accept the king's divorce from Queen Catherine of Aragon. Now, Thomas More, that's a portrait of him that hangs in New York at the Frick. It's truly beautiful in person. More, he was a great scholar as well as a man in an active profession. So his scholarship was kind of rich with his experience illuminates his scholarship. His scholarship illuminated his legal career. Very interesting figure in that regard. And he ensured that his daughters, not just his son, received the best education possible. He was one of the best educated men in all of Europe, and he made sure his children received as much of that education as he could pass on to them. And the most talented and most famous of his children was his eldest daughter, Margaret More Roper. Roper was her married name. She lived from 1505 to 1544. And thanks to the attention that Thomas More paid to her gifts and education, she became one of the most highly educated women in all of Europe, and people talked about her at other courts. And in a way, that was kind of, he didn't necessarily want people to be talking about his daughter, because when you're a highly educated woman in this context, you're a bit of an oddity and can create some trouble. But she was able to do okay on the marriage market despite that. So she learned Latin and Greek, theology and philosophy, and ancient poetry and rhetoric, all subjects that women were increasingly discouraged from studying at that time. And even most men, of course, were unfree to pursue. You know, when we focus on women's history like this, we emphasize men, women versus men, but most men were illiterate, farming fields and doing ordinary jobs. Most men were not being educated either. Now, in time, she wrote her own original Latin orations, treatises, poems, and she stunned learned and powerful men, including the King of England, with her fluency in classical languages. And at only 19, she produced a very fine English translation of a text by one of the most famous humanists, Erasmus, his devout treatise on Our Father. And the quality of that translation is noted by scholars. And what's kind of funny about it is Erasmus, I don't know if any of you have heard of Erasmus, depending on what you've studied. He was a Catholic. He never left the Catholic Church, but he shaded toward unorthodox on certain things. I like to say he liked Plato a bit too much. He should have read a little more Aristotle. Margaret More, before she was More Roper, she didn't like some of his ways when he got a little far from orthodoxy. So in the English translation, she kind of catches him and makes sure he's like more orthodox in English. So that her own stamp is on it. It's kind of amusing. Scholars have noticed this about it. I haven't read this text in detail, but you can read the English translation. It's available. Now, sadly, most of her works disappeared. She spent most of her final years preserving the legacy of her father's writings, because when he was executed, the family was deep shame, and his great career was now, he was kind of canceled in the worst way possible in England. And so she spent her final years helping her husband write a biography of her father. and then preserving his writings, and no one bothered to preserve most of hers, sadly. But Thomas More himself, we have surviving letters acknowledging that some of her work, in his view, was as fine as some of his own, and even he was incredibly proud of her. And there's a particularly poignant letter that survives from him to her. And he says, old-fashioned language, he says, "You are to be pitied because the incredulity of men, men's just disbelief that a woman could be this intelligent, robs you of the praise you so richly deserve." So while he was getting praised as the greatest humanist in England, his daughter's not receiving prayer because everyone's assuming, oh, her father must have written that or something, or she must have gotten help. So she's robbed of the praise that she so richly deserved, as they never believe when they read what you have written that you have not often availed yourself of another's help. But, my sweet Margaret, you are all the more deserving of praise on this account. Although you cannot hope for an adequate reward for your labor, yet nevertheless you continue to unite to your singular love of virtue the pursuit of literature and art for its own sake. She's not getting much of a reward from it in the worldly sense. I want to wrap this up, so try to shorten this a little bit. Now, the activities of humanistic women like this, I think, really open the doors. I opened this lecture with some discussions of women who were accepted into universities, in rare cases in the 17th and 18th centuries. I think without these, I forgot to switch it there. This kind of opened the door, and especially in Italy and Spain, where this humanistic culture was flourishing, it kind of makes sense that women start to be welcomed in little ways into the academies, into universities even. And since learning about women like the ones I told you about, I've been learning about others that I wish I could have included in the book. So it's that once I started working on this, it has started to open doors. I'm finding so many things that are shocking me in every century. I'm looking at the 19th century now, and the number of women involved in writing histories and very publicly, like producing a lot, with often churchmen writing introductions saying, "This is a very learned woman, read what she says." It's kind of giving, showing me that there's kind of this lie we have that the church in general was trying to suppress learned women. I think some in the church were, but many, many churchmen and laymen were encouraging women's learning and even public activity. So I'm trying to kind of resurrect some of these lesser-known stories with my scholarship so that we don't forget these women. And I wanted to just say a bit more personally in wrapping up that one thing that motivates me in this, as a Catholic woman who decided some years ago to go into higher education and advance historical scholarship, I confess I really wish I had known about these kinds of women when I was your age. Because I really felt that somehow, I grew up in a very traditional family, like strong gender roles, military men and women who stay at home typically. And I felt that the stuff I was drawn to was somehow not feminine, because all the models I had that I respected, I loved Thomas More, Augustine of Hippo, all these figures, I kind of associated the stuff that I felt called to with sort of a male activity, and I went into it anyway, but I didn't like sort of the feminist narratives that I was hearing either. I didn't want to be against this tradition that I felt was part of who I was. If I had known back then how many female role models in history there were for me, I think I would have had a different experience just doing my work, when I started out on the job market and all that. So I really am motivated to try to make sure other young Catholics, men and women, know that there are figures like this, especially if they're drawn to the life of the mind and scholarship in whatever field. And I have nieces and nephews, and you know, they all have copies of my book, and they brag about it if they go to Catholic schools that, you know, their aunt wrote this book or whatever. But I really wrote it for them because I didn't want them growing up knowing only role models really from one side, or the only role models for women in the Catholic world tend to be mystics, virgins who get killed by evil Romans, or the occasional, you know, like these tremendously heroic, very unusual saints. Joan of Arc. I mean, it's hard to imitate Joan of Arc. So I don't know. There's a great variety of women in the arts and sciences who were faithfully Catholic women, and there are many women in many other areas of the church's life that more Catholics could stand to know. So, anyways, that's about what I wanted to say, and I hope, you know, I got into the weeds here. Some things I went a little bit longer than I meant to. I'm sorry about that. Thank you so much for inviting me. Hopefully you got something out of that.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.